Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Artrageous. I'm your host, Carrie, and this week I'm here to piggyback off of last week's episode about the Ghent altarpiece. If you haven't listened to it yet, then please take a few minutes to check it out because it has some really cool info about the Ghent altarpiece and some of the stuff that happened to it in its early days. And if you have listened to that episode, and if you've been waiting for part two to come out this week because my bad planning last week forced us to have a part two, then welcome back and thank you so much for sticking with me as I muddle my way through creating podcast episodes and learn as I fly by the seat of my pants each week to make these episodes happen. The good news about this week's part two episode is that we got the still cool but comparatively boring stuff out of the way last week, and this week I can jump right into the much more entertaining portions of the Ghent altarpiece's history. At this point in the story, the Ghent altarpiece has almost gone through fire and flame, has been dismembered and stolen by Napoleon Bonaparte during the French Revolution in the late 1700s, was pawned off and sold by a crooked church official, and was surprisingly brought back together in 1920. Well, unfortunately for the Ghent altarpiece, I promised more to this story, and there is a whole lot more of those shenanigans where that came from. Would you believe me if I told you that the Ghent altarpiece's series of unfortunate events continued in a way that was even more dramatic and unfortunate than the plot of a Lemony Snicket novel? Yeah, all of that other stuff was a slow burn leading up to what happened in 1934. On the morning of April 11th, 1934, a church steward entered the church to do his daily rounds. He lit some candles, rang the bells, and as he went to unlock the doors to let people in for the morning service, he was surprised to see that one parishioner had already made her way inside the church. It turns out someone had left the door unlocked overnight. The steward quickly ran to check the room where the church's jewels and articles of worship were housed, and as he took inventory of everything, he gave a huge sigh of relief when he realized that nothing had been stolen. With that crisis averted, he went about his work as usual, and around 7 a.m., he entered the chapel where the Ghent altarpiece was covered with a giant cloth that was used to protect it from the sun and dust. While he was setting things up for the tourists that came every day to come see this altarpiece, he lifted up the drapes covering the Ghent altarpiece, and he realized that his spidey senses tingling with suspicions of something being stolen had in fact been correct. If you're looking at the Ghent altarpiece, there were two missing panels. The first and most noticeable missing panel, if the altarpiece's wings are open, was the lower left panel, which shows an equestrian scene and is named the Just Judges. The other missing panel was from the other side of that same wing. So if you were to close the piece, it would be the bottom panel, second from the left, that depicts St. John the Baptist. News of the missing panels spread like wildfire, and within a few hours, hordes of people showed up to check out this situation. We're talking like 1,500 people gathering in this church at the scene of the crime. As people were standing around staring at what clearly wasn't there, the police commissioner made his way in, took one look at the missing panel, and just walked out. Wait, what? A piece of one of the most revolutionary and iconic pieces in the entire art world was missing, and he just walked away? Why would he do that? Well, it turns out there was also a theft at a cheese shop across the street that same night. And this commissioner determined that the theft at the cheese shop was just a little more pressing. I literally cannot even make this stuff up, guys. I wish I was more creative and could come up with fun little twists and turns when telling stories to make things more interesting, but sometimes the story just writes itself, and in this case, it was absolutely hilarious. Iconic work of art that took an entire treaty ending an entire world war to get back? Cheese. Revolutionary and ultra-symbolic religious symbols that's one of the greatest achievements of the early Renaissance? Nope, cheese. Cheese is more important. Oh well, I guess we know where this guy's priorities stood. But regardless of the police commissioner's initial lack of interest in the theft of the panels, this was just one of the multiple bizarre twists in this heist. You would think that as soon as the cheese shop thing was over, they would come back and investigate more, right? Turns out the local police did very little at all. They did not clear the huge crowd and secure the crime scene. They did not take photos or look for fingerprints or footprints or whatever evidence they could find. Instead, when the crowd got too big, the commissioner and the four other investigators just left the chapel entirely. But oh, thank goodness, the federal authorities showed up because they were such a big help. Instead of walking away to the cheese shop across the street, they looked at the crime scene and filed a report that basically equated to a little more than a shrug of their shoulders. So the investigation was basically a sitting duck dead in the water. Nothing else really happened until 3 weeks later. A random note in a green envelope appeared, demanding 1 million Belgian francs for the return of the two panels. That's equal to about $25,000 today, so nothing completely obscene, but still the bishop took the note to the authorities. Based on the old "we don't barter with criminals" mindset, the payment was never made. A few days later, another ransom note arrived in the bishop's mail where the thieves threatened to slice up the paintings and mail him the pieces if the ransom wasn't paid. So the bishop decided to fake compliance and published a note in the classified sections of the newspaper saying that they would pay the ransom. I'm guessing it was kind of like a show of good faith or maybe just an act of complete stupidity, but the thieves had promised to return the St. John the Baptist painting before receiving the money. And while this left the police very confused about how someone could be so silly to give up their leverage, they figured it was worth a shot. A few days later, another letter appeared in the bishop's mail, and this one included a mysterious luggage claim ticket for the train station. The back panel featuring St. John the Baptist had mysteriously appeared at the Ghent train station for the police to find and recover. After rushing to the train station, the claim ticket was exchanged for a giant flat package wrapped in black wax paper, and inside was the St. John the Baptist panel. The police investigated and kind of asked people in the train station, whether it be workers or passerbys, if they had seen anything, but they couldn't find any real leads on who the person was that had dropped the package off at the train station. They had run into yet another dead end, but at least one of the two missing panels had been recovered. Another couple days passed and another letter arrived in the mail. This letter requested that the bishop go to a different church, this time in Antwerp, Belgium, bringing the ransom money and a piece of torn newspaper that would be used as a key for the transaction. So one of the investigators followed the instructions of the thieves. They took a wad of ransom money and wrapped it in brown paper, and they took the torn newspaper slip to the church. The investigator gave the package and the newspaper slip to one of the priests that would serve kind of like an intermediary of sorts. A few days later, a taxi pulled up to the church and asked the priest to see the newspaper slip that acted as the key to the transaction. This mysterious person matched up the priest's half of the newspaper with their half, and when it was a match, the person took the parcel with the ransom money and just drove off. And if you're thinking what I'm thinking, this was a ton of steps and hoops to jump through, but at the same time, it's kind of weird and interesting, and I'm kind of loving it. But what happened next? Well, it turns out that the investigator had not put the full 1 million francs in the parcel. Instead, the package contained only 25,000 francs, and they were all traceable. Needless to say, the thieves were not happy about that one. As per the communication pattern previously established with letters to the bishop and authorities responding using the local newspaper, there was some additional communication back and forth between the authorities and the thieves, but negotiations kind of sputtered and no real progress was made. Authorities weren't too worried, though, because at this point, all they really had to do was wait. Logically, the thieves would not dare destroy the panel now because it would be like stuffing money down a paper shredder. The police just needed to wait for the thieves to make a mistake. Time was on their side. Or so they thought. 7 months after these panels had been stolen, on November 25th, 1934, a stockbroker named Arsène Gaudertier collapsed and was rushed to a physician who thought that the man had had a heart attack. Gaudertier then asked to speak to his lawyer, and when his lawyer showed up, they had a quick 15-minute conversation, and then the lawyer left. From there, the lawyer drove to Gaudertier's home and picked up an envelope with carbon copies of ransom notes. Apparently, Gaudertier had told his lawyer, "I alone know where the Mystic Lamb is." And Gaudertier told his lawyer that the information for the missing panel was in the envelope that the lawyer had in his hand. As if the story was written by a novelist that's perfectly orchestrating these events, as the lawyer was looking through the papers, Gaudertier decides to die on us and is of no further help in this story. Well, as you think would be pretty on brand for a lawyer character in this story, the lawyer decided to not tell the authorities about any of this. He did not tell them about what Gaudertier said on his deathbed, and he did not tell them about the copies of the ransom notes. Instead, he met with four legal colleagues. You know how the joke goes, right? A district attorney, two court of appeals presidents, a lawyer, and the crown prosecutor that had been leading the ransom negotiations all walk into a bar, and they start their own investigation separate from the police. Despite this, they did not find much. They found a fake passport with a bogus name, the typewriter that Gaudertier used to type his ransom notes, which, oh, by the way, they did not log as evidence, but instead used to type their reports. They also discovered that just a few days after that initial theft of the panels, Gaudertier had opened a brand new bank account and deposited 10,000 francs. On top of that, they found a key that years later they realized was to a door at St. Bavo's Cathedral. And while all of this looks very suspicious and incriminating, none of this made any sense to these guys. Gaudertier did not need the money, considering he died with 3 million francs in the bank. If we look at his life, he also didn't fit the profile for the thief that police were looking for. After all, he was closely connected to Ghent's Catholic Church and was the type of person who might be expected to give money to the diocese, not take it. Plus, he was in no physical shape to steal two large paintings, considering that he was overweight and had vision problems. This profile just did not fit. And yet there weren't any other clues that indicated who an accomplice might have been. So at that point, I guess they were stumped and figured it was time to turn it over to the real investigators at the police force. Of course, none of them were ever punished for not telling the police and interfering with their investigation, but the real crime here is how badly the police botched the investigation once they had this new information. First of all, the police never interviewed the lawyer who heard Gaudertier's confession. They also did not interview a woman who told the newspaper she had seen movement in the church the night of the theft. They also never investigated local post offices where the letters would have been mailed. After all, how many people are sending green envelopes to the bishop's house? It's logical to think that the local post office people probably knew something that could have helped. The police also never even examined those ransom notes for fingerprints. There were just so many big misses and mistakes in this investigation. I will give them credit for this one, though. They did interview Gaudertier's wife. She said that he would make strange comments about the Ghent altarpiece where he would say things like, "If I had to go looking for the panel, I would look on the outside of St. Bavo." Another comment that he made was that the panel hadn't been stolen, it had just been moved. Apparently, according to Gaudertier, if you move something, it's not stolen. To this day, that panel still has not been recovered, and it's a total mystery where it might be. The final clue that we do have about its location comes from a sentence in Gaudertier's last unmailed letter. "The just judges are in a place where neither I nor anyone else can take it without drawing the public's attention." Is this thing hidden in plain sight? Did Godert TA throw it up on the roof or behind the pipe organ? The police have tried to find this painting, but no sign of it has been found yet. The cathedral has been searched at least 6 times since World War II, including an entire X-ray. I'm sure armchair detectives are having a blast trying to crack this case, and I actually really hope they do someday because I am very intrigued by where this missing panel could be hiding. In the meantime, rather than leave this case open and collecting dust, the case was officially closed 3 years after the theft in 1937, and the panel is officially deemed lost. There is still an investigator assigned to the case, though, in case more information comes in. And every once in a while, there are still pieces of the puzzle that come trickling in and weird things that happen with this case. Just one example, and probably a more extreme one, is how in 1995, an amateur detective illegally dug up Godertier's skull and questioned it during a seance. Let's just say that those bones did not do much talking. And while that is kind of a bummer, I was thinking about it, and I realized that if you're looking at pictures of the Ghent altarpiece today, why is that panel visible? Why is it not missing like it should be? There were no high-res, full-color digital cameras back in 1934, so how do we have these really great pictures of a complete altarpiece today? Even if you were to ever go see the Ghent altarpiece in person, there would be a panel where the Just Judges is said to be missing. The reason for that is that a Belgian art conservator named Jeff van der Wieken made a replica of the Just Judges painting that he gave to St. Bavo's Cathedral to display in the original panel's absence. This drew a whole lot of scrutiny and suspicion from people, though, because van der Wieken chose to work on the panel on his own. He was not asked by anyone at the church. Even weirder, he began working on it just a few months after the failure of the 1938 ransom attempt. My biggest question is, how was he able to recreate it if the source material was missing? Short of being some kind of savant with an insane photographic memory, how could he create such a convincing and detailed replica without any reference to work from? Did he really have the original and he was trying to pass it off as a replacement just to offload it? Or did he somehow have access to the original that allowed him to copy it so perfectly? What's super intriguing is that on the back of van der Wieken's panel, there's a poem that reads, "I did it for love and duty and to avenge myself. I borrowed from the dark side." That's kind of cryptic and suspicious. But no, using modern conservation, restoration, and scientific testing, it is confirmed that van der Wieken's painting is not the original, or just painted over the original. That means that the original Just Judges panel is still missing. So that has to be the end of this story, right? The Ghent altarpiece has to still be around today, minus a missing panel, but probably safe and sound behind all kinds of security measures, bulletproof glass with a climate-controlled encasement to prevent deterioration, with guards, cameras, motion detectors, and laser beam alarm systems that protect it from any more misfortune, right? Well, yes, kinda, but not exactly. I'll explain after this quick break. All right, everyone, welcome back. Before the break, I asked if you would believe me if I told you that the story of the Ghent altarpiece got even weirder. Well, unfortunately for this work, but fortunately for our modern day entertainment, there was still more to this story. It turns out that the Germans are apparently obsessed with this piece. I'm not sure what their fixation is, but aside from their attempts to complete their full set of panels during the First World War, the Germans tried to get their mitts on it again during World War II. Now that I think about it, this piece is also apparently a magnet for crazy, power-hungry dictators, too, because this is the second time that a country's crazy leader has targeted the panels of the Ghent altarpiece. Now, we know from the very first episode of Artrageous that the Nazi Party was an absolutely huge fan of stealing art on behalf of their ruler, Adolf Hitler. A basic recap of that is that the goal of the Nazi Party was to rid Germany of art created during a period known as the Weimar Republic. This was between 1924 and 1930, when Germany was a leading cultural center for art, cinema, and literature. The Nazi regime was not too big a fan of the decadence surrounding the Weimar Republic's art, and that led to Hitler shutting down art schools and purging the so-called degenerate art from the public. Basically, anything of French or German origin in the areas of Cubism, Expressionism, and Impressionism were deemed degenerate and were removed. To give you an idea, that first wave accounted for approximately 16,000 pieces. What started out as an ideological principle soon morphed into their weird organized government policy that was used to justify their confiscation of all kinds of art. Beginning in 1938, the Germans started in Austria, worked their way through Poland, and then through newly occupied territories. Not only was Adolf Hitler an avid art lover that wanted to collect everything in sight, but one of the members of his inner circle was also a collector. This is where we saw the creation of the ERR, led by Hermann Göring, who made it their job to confiscate prominent art collections in Western Nazi-occupied territories. From 1940 to 1944, the ERR looted more than 21,000 individual objects from over 200 collections. There was just so much art being looted left and right that it was honestly just an absolute mess. There were works being stolen, cataloged, and hidden in salt mines. There were designated groups of the U.S. forces assigned to try to play cat and mouse and get these works back. It was crazy. But how does all of this relate to the Ghent altarpiece? Well, if you've seen the 2014 movie The Monuments Men, you might remember that at the end of the movie, they're finding all of these works hidden in salt mines throughout the countryside, and the Ghent altarpiece was one of the works that was mentioned being recovered from these salt mines. So the Ghent altarpiece, unfortunately, was one of the works that got tied up in all of this mess as well. Like it had long before the war, the fame and splendor of the Ghent altarpiece was pretty widespread, and that brought it to the attention of the Nazis. Like we talked about last week, there was, of course, previous interest during the First World War when they had their hands on six side panels and they really wanted to complete the collection by trying to steal the center four panels. Well, their long-term plan of playing Pokemon and collecting them all didn't quite pan out the way they expected it to, because then, in 1919, one of the stipulations of the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I was that the pieces of the Ghent altarpiece that the Germans had were to be returned to St. Bavo's Cathedral in Ghent, Belgium. I think there's an argument to be made that part of the reason Hitler and Göring wanted this piece so badly was in part a viewpoint that acquiring the Ghent altarpiece would right the wrongs, if you will, of the Treaty of Versailles that took the piece from the Germans. Another interesting theory that I came across was speculation that Hitler believed that the Ghent altarpiece was actually a coded map to locate lost Christian relics that, if found, would grant supernatural powers to the person who possessed them. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but this is a podcast that is a home for those very weird factoids, so I kind of love it. Who knows? Maybe this really was one of the reasons that Joseph Goebbels sent a Nazi art detective looking for the missing Just Judges panel so that when the other panels were brought to Hitler, he could also be gifted the full set of panels and have this complete map to find these hidden relics. An interesting side story here is that the art detective Goebbels sent in search of the missing panels traveled to Ghent and interviewed dozens of people, including Godertier's family and Godertier's lawyer, who we talked about in the first half of the episode. Afterwards, that lawyer mysteriously died while in a movie theater. It was never determined if foul play was involved, but it is a very big and very suspicious coincidence. Regardless, just 6 years after the events with the missing panels, Germany invaded Belgium as part of their sweeping military endeavors across Europe. At that time, the Belgian government thought it would probably be a good idea to send the Ghent altarpiece to the Vatican for safekeeping. The panels were pulled down, packed up nice and neatly, and then sent south through France on their trip to Italy. Well, while en route, Mussolini declared Italy's alignment with Germany as an Axis power in the war. So all of a sudden, Italy was not the best place to send this altarpiece if they wanted to keep it from falling into the hands of the Germans. My assumption at this point is that someone somewhere in Italy knew that the Ghent altarpiece was on its way and then relayed that information to someone somewhere else. And I'm thinking this because when the Ghent altarpiece changed course to be hidden somewhere other than the Vatican, the Nazis intercepted the shipment with the panels. It was either a stroke of really good luck on their part, or there was some intelligence somewhere that tipped them off. I'm not sure, and I wasn't able to find more information on that point exactly, but the point of the matter is that the Germans now had the Ghent altarpiece. For a while, it was stored at a museum in Pau, France. If you're looking at a map, Pau is south and close-ish to France's border with Spain. The deal that was made here is that this would be where the Ghent altarpiece would stay for the duration of the war. But if it ever needed to be moved, that move had to be agreed upon by French, Belgian, and German representatives. Well, Hitler was very anxious to have the Ghent altarpiece moved to Germany. So in July 1942, he ordered the move of the entire altar to Neuschwanstein Castle, which at that point was being used as a kind of home base for the art-collecting German ERR. This seizure and movement of the painting was led by a senior museum administrator and was aided by officials in France. Someone definitely lost their job over that one, and that is not including the head of the German Army's Art Protection Unit, who disagreed with the seizure and was fired because of disagreeing. But nonetheless, the Ghent altarpiece was moved to Neuschwanstein Castle. The altarpiece only had a short stay there because eventually Allied bombing made that location too dangerous of a place to keep it. So at that point, it was moved to the Alt-Aussee salt mine in Austria, along with a whole bunch of other works that were intended for Hitler's museum in Linz. At first, I wasn't sure why they moved it to a salt mine rather than Linz or even Berlin, but the more I think about it, maybe underground really was a good place for these pieces. The museum in Linz was never actually built, so that wouldn't necessarily be a good place to store over 6,000 pieces of art. And in the case of Berlin, that was being constantly bombed between 1940 and 1945, so that probably also wasn't a very good idea. I'm thinking anything above ground where bombs could reach these art pieces wasn't good. So by hiding them below ground in salt mines, not only did that provide some pretty good physical protection, but it's kind of a random spot that the Allied powers wouldn't really think of initially to search for all of this stuff, because it is just so random. But the story of how the Ghent altarpiece was found and saved from the Alt-Aussee salt mine is really interesting in itself. The Allied powers knew about the Nazi art confiscations as early as 1943. And even though at that point there was still that monumental task of liberating Europe, President Roosevelt authorized the formation of a group of professors and museum curators that were hired for their museum experience and art history education. These men were basically special soldiers in the U.S. Armed Forces, but their main goal was to identify, locate, recover, and protect cultural treasures like art in these European war zones. This group was called the Roberts Commission, but became more popularly known as the Monuments Men. Two of the Monuments Men were stationed about 350 miles away from Alt-Aussee when one of them got a toothache. Now, being out in a field in a war zone and suddenly having a dental emergency seems kind of inconvenient in the broad scheme of things. But I've had toothaches before and they are so annoying, so I can totally understand why they would choose to go on a side quest to find a dentist. Well, as fate would have it, the dentist they went to got to talking to them, and he mentioned he had a son-in-law who also happened to love art. The dentist took these two guys to meet his son-in-law, and it turns out that the son-in-law was actually one of the Nazis' former art advisors that was currently in hiding for some reason or another. I'm assuming there was some bonding and connecting over their shared love of art, because this former art advisor told the two Monuments Men everything he knew, whether it was out of hatred for the people he was hiding from or just a love of art and not wanting to see some of the world's greatest treasures get lost or destroyed. I'm not sure. But it ended up being some really good timing, because as all of this was happening, Patton's Third Army was bearing down on Alt-Aussie, and one of the German commanders was giving the order to blow up the salt mine and seal it off so that U.S. forces wouldn't take it. We're talking about 8 bombs, 1,100 pounds each, being drug into the mines to detonate and bring down the house. To put that into perspective, if my math and conversions are roughly correct, each bomb alone was capable of creating a 500-foot crater into the ground. So 8 of those underground, that was going to be a fairly hefty explosion that surely could not be good for all of these art pieces down there with them. And you might be thinking, like I am, how on earth would Hitler ever be okay with this? And really, he wasn't, but he couldn't really say much to stop this German general because Hitler was dead. Which kind of explains why the entire German military operation was crumbling and everyone was panicking and trying to save themselves by retreating and blowing things up as they went. Luckily, the local resistance made up of mine administration and miners were able to delay the orders to detonate the bombs just long enough for U.S. forces to get there while the German forces retreated. The Monuments Men then found the Ghent altarpiece, over 6,000 other works, and a metric crap ton of gold bars worth millions in European currency. All of that was stashed in this salt mine. From there, they had everything transported to a central art collection point in Europe where they could begin the tedious restitution process. Some of those pieces are still trying to find their way back to their original owners, but the Ghent altarpiece was one of the easier ones to figure out where it should go. The Ghent altarpiece was returned to Belgium, and there was a huge celebration. We're talking about a full-on ceremony that was presided over by Belgian royalty at the Royal Palace of Brussels, where all of these panels were temporarily put on display for the press. The only people that were not invited to this party were the French officials that just stood by and let the Germans take the altarpiece from the museum in 1942. The Ghent altarpiece was finally returned to its current home at St. Bavo's Cathedral in Ghent in October 1945, and over the next decade, it went through restoration processes to fix some of the damage from all of that moving and the less than optimum conditions of the Alt-Aussie salt mine. Today, the Ghent altarpiece is still on display at St. Bavo Cathedral, but it's now protected by a climate-controlled glass case and is very closely monitored by security and art enthusiasts alike. In the end, it sounds like the Ghent altarpiece has been through a lot in its almost 600 years, and I think that is putting it mildly. It's been forged, pillaged, dismembered, censored, stolen by Napoleon, hunted in the First World War, pawned and sold by a renegade cleric, then stolen repeatedly during the Second World War. I don't know if there's anything the Ghent altarpiece hasn't seen or been through in its lifetime, but it has thankfully escaped mostly unscathed. This piece of story really does sound like something out of a movie, which thank you to Hollywood for kind of sort of covering that base. But yeah, it is a truly wild story that was a lot of fun to look into for these last couple episodes. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode because I had a lot of fun researching it and telling the story. So thank you for sticking with me as I broke it into two parts and went through all of that craziness. But if you did like this story in this episode, please take literally 5 seconds to leave me a 5-star review in your podcast app. And if you have 30 seconds, feel free to write a review as well. I haven't had a written review in a while, and maybe I'm opening myself up to the proverbial firing squad with that request, but I'd still love to hear your feedback on this episode or the show in general. It's a little weird creating episodes in a vacuum each week, not really knowing what you guys like or want to hear, so I'm kind of just sprinkling in stories as they catch my interest. That being said, I have zero clue what's on deck for next week, so stay tuned because you will probably be just as surprised as me when I find the next fun story. I will be back next Thursday with another episode, but until then, stay outrageous.
Series music created by Arenson. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Outrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.